KFRS Sports Reel. It's another colorful edition of the AFRS Sports Reel. That means an action-packed quarter hour of camera highlights from the sports world about outstanding events and personalities. With us today are Jimmy Young and Bill Brandt. First up, here's an amusing sidelight from the football gridiron. And Bill Brandt to tell us all about it.
Signals. If you're an All-American football player and your career's over, what do you want most of all in the world? Right. A son to grow up and get into that game and follow your footsteps. So here's Ed McGinley, All-American at the University of Pennsylvania in 1924. Here's Ed in the bleachers at a high school game in New Jersey. And there's young Ed down on the bench with the subs. It's a hot football game, a pile-up at midfield. Look, young Ed McGinley, he's up off the bench, prancing up and down the sidelines. Here he goes, says old Ed up in the bleachers. And the old man holds his breath and begins to sweat. Hey, what's the idea? Young Ed sits down on the bench again. The coach must have changed his mind. Now it's 2 minutes later. Look, young Ed's warming up again. More puffing and sweating by Dad. No, the kid's down again. Junior resumes his seat on the bench with the rest of the subs. This happens 18 different times. Now the game's over, and young Ed McGinley has never been closer to the game than the sideline, just running up and down. Old man McGinley's exhausted. Son, that's too bad, he says consolingly. What's too bad, says Junior? Why, you almost got into the game there 18 different times, but... Oh, no, Dad, says Junior McGinley. I never had a chance to get in there today. Well, then what's the idea of the warm-up? Well, Dad, you see, we have a very stupid quarterback. The coach has to tell him everything. Whenever I run up and down on the sidelines, it means the coach wants a forward pass. That's the position I was playing today, Pop. I'm the signal for the forward pass.
Thanks, Bill Brandt. We'll be looking forward to hearing one of your once-in-a-lifetime yarns later in the program. First, though, here's Jimmy Young with a story about a memorable event of a few years ago. Come in, Jimmy.
Thanks, Bill. Perhaps the most important game of the 1940 football season was Michigan and Minnesota's battle for the Little Brown Jug. It not only decided the Big Ten championship, it also turned into a personal duel between two great All-American backs, Bruce Smith of Minnesota and Tommy Harmon of Michigan. The game started in a downpour of rain. The first quarter was strictly a punting duel. Neither team could get rolling on a soft, muddy field. Harmon of Michigan would kick, and then George Frank of Minnesota would boot the ball back again. When the whistle blew for the start of the second quarter, it was like a signal call to battle. Starting on their own 14-yard line, the Michigan Wolverines roared downfield. Harmon was their big gun as he passed and ran Michigan to the Gopher 1-yard line. Fourth down, goal to go. The Michigan line smashed the Gophers wide open. Harmon had the ball and was headed for sure pay dirt. But Michigan's All-American star slipped in the mud and fell inches short of a touchdown. It was then Minnesota's ball. After an exchange of kicks, Bill Daly of Minnesota fumbled and Bob Westfall of Michigan recovered. Minutes later, Tom Harmon took the ball, ran it to his left, and fired a perfect strike to his teammate, Forrest Evashevsky. Touchdown for Michigan. Harmon missed the extra point by a hair. On the top side of the 6-0 score now, Michigan kicked off. Minnesota couldn't seem to gain. Again, Frank went back to kick, but this time, Frutig of Michigan broke through and blocked the kick. Michigan recovered on the 3-yard line, and things looked bad, but Minnesota's Golden Gophers held. Harmon's pass was intercepted, and the Gophers took over on the 20. On the muddy gridiron, the Gophers lined up. All-American Bruce Smith was in the tailback. Smith grabbed the pigskin, tucked it under his arm, and headed for left tackle. He flashed through a narrow hole in the line, danced to the 25-yard line, twisted to the 30, the 35, the 40, midfield. He dodged, he cut, then burst into the clear, the 15, the 10, the 5. He thundered over the goal line, a touchdown in 80 yards of glory. 60,000 voices rose in a crescendo of cheers, and then sudden quiet. Down the long bench, the Minnesota coach was looking squarely at Joe Mernick, substitute halfback. Get in there, Joe, the Minnesota bench strained and listened. Kick that extra point. The scoreboard read Michigan 6, Minnesota 6, as Joe Mernick ran on the field to join his mud-soaked comrades. Huddle, and then out onto the line. Joe looked down to make sure there was no mud on his shoe. He took the step, booted it. and then waited. The yells of a crowd gone wild echoed as Joe looked up to see the pigskin spin over the bar, a perfect kick. Minnesota 7, Michigan 6. Yes, Minnesota won. The rest of the game, that great golfer line, stopped Harmon and company cold. Minnesota went on to an undefeated, untied season. Harmon and Smith both became immortal as All-Americans. But Joe Mernick had a moment of glory that even the greatest All-American didn't have. He settled the Big Ten championship with one boot from his cleated toe.
Thanks, Jimmy Young. You know, that yarn you just told reminds me of a game I saw a few years back.
It all happened on November 11th, 1939, when the Fighting Irish of Notre Dame invaded Iowa City to do battle with the Hawkeyes. The Notre Dame team was riding on the crest of a six-game winning streak, and that game with Iowa was supposed to be a breather for the Irish. There was no getting away from it. The Irish had an imposing record. Purdue, Georgia Tech, Southern Methodist, Navy, Carnegie Tech, and Army, all great names in the world of football. Yet the Irish had taken the measure of all six, and it looked as if 1939 was going to be the year for the Irish to really howl an undefeated season, the first in 9 years. The Hawkeyes had gone through a fairly successful season themselves. They'd won 4 out of 5 of their games. But as for beating Notre Dame, well, that was almost beyond the fondest hopes of the most ardent Iowa rooter. More than 46,000 fans jammed into the stadium. Just a few honestly thought the Hawkeyes could win. The Irish trotted out in the field, green jerseys shining in the sunlight. Even in warm-up, they looked powerful. The Notre Dame team wasn't overconfident, either. They remembered that back in 1921, an Irish team had invaded Iowa with a 21-game winning streak. The Hawkeyes burst that bubble with a 10-7 win. The first period settled down to a scoreless duel. The Irish got started a couple of times, drove into Hawkeye territory, but they just couldn't reach that pay dirt. The teams changed ends of the field. Once again, they drove up and down the gridiron, and the Irish mixed passes with a powerful ground attack. Iowa stuck strictly to hitting the line and circling those ends. Then late in the second period, Niall Kinnick, Iowa's great halfback, dropped back and tossed the first pass for the Hawkeyes. It was intercepted. Steve Sitko grabbed the leather for the end zone and brought it back on the playing field. As Sitko started upfield, he was hit and hit hard by center Bruno Andruska. The ball popped out of his arms and Iowa recovered on the Irish 4-yard line. 2 plays later, Kinnick plowed over and Iowa led 6-0. Then Kinnick made it 7-0 as he drop-kicked the extra point. The Irish opened in the third period as though they were going to run away with the game. Time and time again, they drove deep into Iowa territory, but still they couldn't score. Then late in the third period, Notre Dame again started moving. Sitko flipped a pass to end Bill Kerr. The rangy wingman went down to the Iowa 23. Milt Peeple and Sitko drove to the 10, the 4, and then Sitko bowled his way over for a touchdown. Lou Zontini, Notre Dame's cool, accurate place kicker, dropped back for the all-important extra point. Zontini'd won 2 games for the Irish that season with his educated toe, and the Notre Dame line braced to give him all the time he needed. The ball rose into the air. For a moment, it looked good. Then it swerved to the left of the goalpost, and Iowa still led 7-6, and that was the way the game ended. Iowa had upset the highly touted Irish from South Bend. The Hawkeyes only tried one pass. It had backfired, and that proved to be the break of the game. Zontini's kick had been off. The Irish team of 1939 was convinced it had the little things that really count.
And now here's Bill Brandt with a once-in-a-lifetime story about 2 thrill-packed baseball games. Okay, Bill.
The Dodgers are in first place, first by 0.5 game. Over the river, the Giants are riding a 26-game winning streak, the all-time record. But it's not enough. The Giants are still in 4th place. The Braves are 3rd, and who's 2nd? Philadelphia, Pat Moran's Phils, the league champions of 1915, with Grover Alexander and Eparixie for their pitchers, and the number one shortstop of the year, Dave Bancroft. And here's the league champions on Saturday morning, 0.5 game behind, ready to jump at the Dodgers and fight them for 1st place. How come they play Saturday morning? Well, the Friday game got rained out in the 2nd inning. Game called. Okay. Why not a Saturday afternoon doubleheader? No. Here's Charlie Ebbets. We're all sold out for Saturday afternoon already. All are reserved in boxes. Only one answer. Crack the doubleheader in half. 1 in the morning... 1 in the afternoon. If it was all right Labor Day, what's the matter with September 30th? Friday rain checks, good only for the morning game. So what can we do, we fans? So here we are, and there's Big Rixie warming up for Philadelphia. The 6'6" southpaw from Culpeper Courthouse, Virginia, the colonel. Who's for Uncle Robbie? Jeff Pepper from Champaign, Illinois. Big Jeff will slap down on those fills, and we'll knock these worn-out champions over the hill. So here we go. No, I guess we don't. Boom! That's a home run by Fred Luderis, Philadelphia first baseman from Milwaukee. Two doubles by Lutie, too. The Dodgers get five hits altogether. Final score, 7-2. Philadelphia wins. And listen to this Brooklyn crowd going out for lunch. We're out of first place, and how are we going to get back? You know who's pitching for Philly this afternoon? Alexander. Yep, we got to wait till next year. Oh, what a bunch of bums. And how about us fans getting up at daybreak just to see those bums blow the pennant? Down in the Philadelphia dressing room, a quartet is harmonizing Tessie. That's the war song of the Boston Red Sox. That's the club they expect to meet in the World Series. Everybody's happy. Wait a minute. Over in the corner is Dave Bancroft, the Phil's great shortstop. He's from Superior, Wisconsin, and he's the spark plug of the ball club. Dave's in trouble, his leg. The trainer's working on him. How do you feel, Dave? Says Pat Moran, the Philadelphia manager from Pittsburgh, Massachusetts. Oh, I'll be all right, Pat. Just a Charlie horse. Must have wrenched it this morning. In the Dodger dressing room, all is quiet except manager Wilbert Robinson. And Robbie's reading the riot act all the way down the line. Now they've got Alec to throw at us this afternoon, and what have we got? Deep silence. Now Uncle Robbie speaks again. Old Rube's our only chance. Let's see if you guys can't give him a little more help than you just gave Jeff. Now Robbie turns to Rube Markward. It's up to you, Rube. Markward nods, then goes on lacing his shoe. Only 4 years ago, Rube Markward from Indianapolis was the ace of the Giants. He won 19 straight, and the streak began and reached its highest peak with victories over Brooklyn. Today, this same Markward is Brooklyn's last hope. It's just a twist of fate. And now the players go out on the field. But where's the crowd? That sellout. Why, it's nowhere near capacity. Yes, it looks as if the fans have given up on the Dodgers. Most of today's reserved seats are in the hands of speculators, all set for a killing. But the speculators are stuck. They can't unload. You can get a reserved seat for a dime out on the street. Charlie Evans tells the scalpers, no refund from the Brooklyn club. So the game starts with a slim crowd, but a bulging cash register in the Evans office. This crucial game is paid for by a lot of people who aren't there. It's completely wacky. Here's a small, silent crowd, and it's the pennant. Both teams score once in the first inning, but there's hardly a sound. Hope dies in the fans' hearts as Alec the Great goes to the box for Philadelphia. Grover Cleveland Alexander from Elba, Nebraska. The fans hardly notice as Bancroft leaves the game in the second inning. The pain in his leg is worse. Now the fans begin to root for the Rube. He's matching Alexander inning after inning. Score, still 1-1 in the fifth. And now here's Casey Stengel from Kansas City up to bat for Brooklyn. Here's the pitch. It's a terrific drive to right field. It's going, going, it's gone. Over the right field wall. A home run for Casey Stengel. Brooklyn ahead, 2-1. Now the sixth, and Markward up at bat. Bang, a three-bagger against the wall in right center. Now a single, and Markward comes home. The ball game's on ice. That's all Markward needs. Final score, 6-1, Brooklyn. Only one hit off the Rube after the first inning. A three-hit masterpiece in the pinch. Rube had that extra something it takes to win 19 straight in 1912. He has that something extra today. He pitches the Dodgers back into first place, and it's the payoff. Because Bancroft has a dislocated hip, he's out of Philadelphia's remaining four games. Philadelphia loses three of them. Pennant for Brooklyn, the first in 1900. And here's what does it. This two-ticket doubleheader, a jammed ballpark in the morning, then the pennant decider in the afternoon with the park all sold out, but only half full. The Dodgers out of first place for lunch, in again for dinner. Saturday, September 30th, 1916. A date just as hysteric as it is historic. A once-in-a-lifetime.
Thanks to you, Bill Brandt. Well, sport fans, we'll be back once again soon with another thrill-packed AFRS sports reel. This is the Armed Forces Radio Service, the voice of information and education.